Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is really good to be back, and we're all hoping you had a wonderful, wonderful new year. On today's show, we all tend to do it. We make those New Year's resolutions, things we promise ourselves we'll do differently in the year to come. Those resolutions are mighty easy to make, but even easier, it seems, to break. We'll talk to a researcher to help explain why it is so hard to keep those resolutions. And we'll look at Muskegon Heights, the state's very first fully privatized school district. We'll take a look at how it's all working and what it means for the students. But first, it was indeed a cliffhanger, a last-minute fiscal cliff package that was finally hammered out and cleared by the House and Senate. The short-term compromise that Congress passed last night may have averted the immediate impacts of that so-called fiscal cliff, but bigger battles lie ahead for Congress and the White House, and taxpayers are left to try to figure out what does it all mean to my bank account. Let's take stock of what happened in the past day or so and what's ahead for the economy as we welcome back Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Cindy. How you doing?
Doing good. Happy New Year. What a roller coaster it was, right?
Yeah.
Now, here's what I was wondering, asking the professor here. If you could grade Congress and the president on what was hammered out this week, what grade would you give them?
Oh, I guess maybe I'd give them a C. I was hoping, and many people were hoping, for a grand bargain, a much more comprehensive attempt to deal with the fiscal problems. What we got was better than an F. It was better than nothing, and it's a step in the right direction. But it also had, in addition to not dealing with all the problems, it had so much drama.
A lot of drama.
A whole lot more drama than most of us need.
And I got the sense a whole lot more drama than Americans want to see, because there were so many comments I saw posted at the end of news stories saying, if I pulled this in my job, I'd be out.
Well, that's true, although the person who would be out of a job, they're in a situation where their boss can fire them.
True.
The problem is that Mitch McConnell can't fire Harry Reid, John Boehner can't fire Nancy Pelosi, and Barack Obama can't fire any of them. So they have to come together. It's also true that with gerrymandering of the legislative districts, we have an unrepresentative House of Representatives. We have a House that emphasizes that has way more quite extreme folks than the average citizen in the country.
And people look at that, and you hear that term government by gridlock, and I just think the national voter temperature is going up and up as this goes on.
And unfortunately, it's likely to go on because, as you alluded to, we really didn't deal with everything. We got some tax agreements done, but the spending part of the fiscal cliff was kicked down the road for two more months. Mm-hmm. And then we will also have the debt ceiling to deal with. So it's very likely, unfortunately, that the economy will once again be held hostage for much of the rest of the winter.
Well, let's go back now and talk about starting with what all of this will mean for us in Michigan as far as the taxes that was decided. So someone making under that new $450,000 threshold, what does this all mean for them?
What it means for them is something important, but that wasn't part of the fiscal cliff negotiations, because every wage earner is going to have an increase in the payroll tax.
Right.
A 2 percentage point increase in the payroll tax. That's not trivial. 2% of your wages. Your payroll tax goes up from 4.2 to 6.2. So for the average wage earner who makes about $40,000, that's about $16 a week. That's not trivial. That's 4 or 5 gallons of gas. I don't think that that's going to be enough to push the economy into recession, which is a good thing. But for most people, that's far more important than a lot of the things that were in the fiscal cliff negotiations.
And what you were referring to is the fact that the expiration of that 2-year payroll tax holiday that was enacted 2 years ago to boost the economy, that's done. And as you say, that wasn't even part of all of this.
That wasn't even part of all of this. And the two sides really didn't disagree on this. It's interesting because it says something about views about the income distribution. there wasn't a big fight about increasing taxes for the average wage earner. The big fight was about whether we should increase taxes for those making over 250 or over 400 or over 450,000.
And so now let's talk to the person about the person who is making over that, either the individual $400,000 threshold or the joint $450,000 threshold. What are they going to have to pay now?
Their tax rate will go up. The top marginal tax rate, the tax rate on one additional dollar of income, will go up from 35% to 39.6% for that group, which is less than 1% of the population. So it's a fairly rarefied group. Now, just to put that in historical perspective, for much of the history of the U.S. income tax, 39.6 is not a particularly high rate. The rate was 91% in the 50s. In the 60s and much of the 70s, it was about 70%, and then it was 50% in much of the 80s. So we're dealing with rates that are high, I suppose. I mean, 39.6, that's not trivial. That's a serious chunk of your paycheck.
But that perspective you gave us.
But it's lower. It's lower than we have had historically.
What about someone who is jobless or they're on federal benefits?
Well, two things about the jobless. One is that the agreement that was reached probably reduces the chance of us going into recession. So you might be able to find a job more easily.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you can't, the long-term unemployment benefits were extended for another year. And that's crucial. And it's especially important in a high unemployment state like Michigan, where even though we've had some big improvements in recent years, we're still above the national average for unemployment.
How about the state budget? Of course, we know the state gets millions and millions of dollars from the feds. Does this change things?
I don't think this changes things for the state budget much yet, but though that's going to be in the negotiations that will be ongoing in the next couple of months, because what was taken care of was the tax side. The spending side of the fiscal cliff has been kicked down the road two more months. If those spending cuts go in, a lot of those things that are at risk are payments that go directly to state governments, and that could put substantial further pressure on the budget in Michigan. It would also affect the universities. Places like U of M and MSU get substantial amounts of grant money from the Federal Energy Department, the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and many other organizations. I hope we have the wisdom not to close the door on that important research.
What about, you alluded to it earlier, we have to talk about this whole issue of the debt ceiling. Now, here's what President Obama said last night about the upcoming fight over the debt ceiling.
One last point I want to make. While I will negotiate over many things, I will not have another debate with this Congress over whether or not they should pay the bills that they have already racked up through the laws that they passed. Let me repeat. We can't not pay bills that we've already incurred. If Congress refuses to give the United States government the ability to pay these bills on time, the consequences for the entire global economy would be catastrophic, far worse than the impact of a fiscal cliff.
What are your thoughts on what he did say and what needs to happen with the debt ceiling?
Well, the economy was held hostage to the debt ceiling back in the summer of 2011, and it did a tremendous amount of damage. It damaged our credit rating for the first time in U.S. history. I hope that doesn't happen again. I agree with President Obama that this is not the kind of thing that we want to play political games with. One thing that I would mention that might enter the mix, it's a risky move, but the president might consider invoking the 14th Amendment. There is language in the 14th Amendment that some constitutional scholars have interpreted as meaning that there ain't no such thing as a debt ceiling, that the U.S. government is not going to question whether it can pay its debts, and we're going to go on and just ignore that. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's one possible argument in the mix.
Zero in just for those of us who are rusty on our constitutional history. The 14th Amendment focuses on
The 14th Amendment was passed in the Reconstruction in 1868, and it had a whole bunch of things in it. The most important was the equal protection and citizenship, saying that African Americans recently freed from slavery were full citizens of the United States. That's the big part of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
But it also has stuff, because there was an argument about, well, should we recognize the Confederate debts? And basically it said, we're not going to recognize the Confederate debts, but the U.S. federal debt is inviolable.
Huh. So we'll have to watch and see if that is worked into the argument. Overall, Charlie, fundamentally, who do you feel are the winners and the losers in what has happened this week with this fiscal cliff package?
Well, I don't think there are a whole lot of really big losers. We all have known for a very long time that we can't continue to run huge deficits. We've got to move toward budget balance, and that the only way to do that is either to raise taxes and or to cut spending. And so I think we're sort of moving in the right direction. Yes, everybody who has an increase in their taxes will grumble, but if we didn't do that, we would put our fiscal credit rating in greater danger down the road. And so I think we're kind of stumbling and staggering in the right direction, and I guess that's better than doing nothing.
Well, it sounds like a C grade, but
I would definitely give it a C. Yes, it's certainly not an A, but it's better than it could have been, because if we had really not reached any agreement, that could have been really bad.
Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard, always good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, Cindy. Thank you for having me.
Still to come. Well, now that we have some real snow and real ice blanketing parts of our state, we're going to look at ice boating in Michigan. Find out more about that sport that rockets you along frozen lakes and rivers. That's in 15 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Now that we have put the wraps on 2012, the weather folks are busy crunching numbers and tracking statistics and trends and trying to determine where it fits into the warming trend. Was 2012 the warmest year on record? And what's ahead for 2013? We turn to Professor Richard Rood, who's a professor of atmospheric, oceanic, and space science at the University of Michigan. He's also the climate change blogger at weatherunderground.com. What is the verdict then, Richard, on 2012 as far as, is it the warmest year on record?
2012 is the warmest year on record for the continental United States. It is not the warmest year on record globally.
So where are we seeing the impacts, especially if we can talk about here in Michigan? Where are you seeing this warmer weather directly impact our state?
So the places that we see the warming weather impacting the state the most, and if you just look at the last year, you had the extraordinarily warm spring with very warm temperatures all over the country in spring, which has a big impact in Michigan because it sort of sets things up by pushing the fruit-bearing trees like cherries and apples to blossom early. But just because you have this very warm early weather does not eliminate that you will still have the frost that normally comes during that season. So it sets up the fruits for these sort of failed crops where you get a bloom burst early and then the fruit is killed by the frost. So that's one place that it's had a significant impact.
We certainly saw that with the Cherry Festival in Traverse City when they had to import cherries from everywhere but Michigan.
Yeah.
That was tough. Yeah. Hard year for the fruit folks.
Right. And that sort of thing is the sort of thing that is expected to continue to happen more as you see sort of the warming periods of spring move earlier and earlier in the year. Because, again, just because you see that warm burst early in the year does not eliminate the possibility of frost and freeze after that. The other places that you're seeing it perhaps what you would say sort of acutely at times, we're seeing you know, when it's warm and dry, you get drought conditions that are also quite severe. And Michigan did see some drought this year. The interesting place that you're seeing it in terms of sort of a general warming trend is that the winter time in the Midwest is where we're seeing quite a bit of warming. And the other sort of curious thing that we saw this past year in terms of an extreme event is when Superstorm Sandy hit the coast and started dissipating inside of the continental boundaries of the United States. There were very, very high winds on Lake Michigan with very, very high waves. So that was, you know, from a Michigan point of view, more of a curiosity than anything else. But there were some trucks blown over and things like mm-hmm. that.
One of the things you do at the University of Michigan, Professor Richard Root, is you teach a class on climate change problem solving, which leads me to wonder, what, if anything, can we as individuals do to alter the climate influence of all these human-caused emissions?
So, yes, I started that class in 2006, and I teach it to mostly graduate students and advanced undergraduates from any department. And I've had students, I think, from virtually, you know, all the academic schools at the University of Michigan there. The way we think about it, things in that course, is right now I'm moving more and more towards people thinking about adaptation to climate change. When we think about what can individuals do, often the conversation for that has been around what can we do to reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Right.
And that's sort of the mitigation problem, trying to mitigate the amount of warming that we'll see. The interesting places that individuals can make the biggest difference there in the short term is with regard to efficiency and efficient use of energy. And if you look at the things that are almost no-brainers in the sense of they would also save you money, improving the insulation in buildings, both residential and commercial, the move over to compact fluorescent lights actually do make a difference when it scales up to a lot of people. And then, you know, doing more simple things like looking for highly efficient computers. So all of those things can help to reduce emissions and essentially a savings of money to people. You know, more efficient cars are also a big issue. And then, as some people would point out, thinking about the way we eat, the food that we eat, also does make a difference, because agriculture and particularly the production of meat is something that releases a lot of greenhouse gases. On the adaptation side, many of the cities in Michigan and many of the cities in the country are now starting to think about what they can specifically do to plan for climate adaptation.
Because when you're talking about adapting, it sounds as, tell me if I'm wrong, we're going to have to learn to just cope and adjust to the fact that we're going to have hotter summers and these freaky bursts of weather that, you know, too warm like we had last spring. It sounds like it's not going to go away, so we're going to have to learn to live with it.
Yes. I mean, what I actually teach in that class, I decided about 2 years ago it was disingenuous to continue to focus on this idea of mitigating and avoiding climate change. And actually what I teach right now is that we are headed to a world that is potentially on average 4 degrees warmer than the current world, and that is beyond the goals, you know, the mitigation goals that have been set by the United Nations Conference of the Parties. And the reason I teach that is I see no evidence that we are reducing our emissions globally fast enough that we will avoid a significant amount of warming. So I think it's absolutely critical that we start thinking about this adaptation problem. If I could give, say, two or three examples of
sure.
the type of adaptation we're thinking about, say, in Michigan cities, a trend we're already seeing is that more of our precipitation is coming in extreme events. So the extreme events, the extreme thunderstorms, perhaps even the extreme winter storms, are bringing us a larger percentage of our precipitation. This does things like stress city storm sewers. It has issues for water quality in not only the lakes, but also in city water supplies. So a city like Ann Arbor is worrying about, you know, the annual sort of stream flow of the Huron River. The second place we're thinking about things a lot is on with regard to extreme heat events within cities, and how do you deal with, you know, extreme heat events like that
as a public health challenge.
As a public health challenge.
And it also strikes me that it could be we need to adjust our expectations as far as how we deal with hot weather. Instead of just saying crank up the air conditioning, we may need to, you know, looking down the road, really review that, don't we?
Well, it's an interesting challenge because there's no doubt that you can address the extreme heat problem for most people with air conditioning. But on the other hand, right now, that doesn't do anything to help the general warming problem.
Right.
Because of the energy use, and our energy use is still largely fossil fuel intensive. So I think, you know, all in all, we do have to think about the sorts of strategies that we, you know, use to address these problems. We can't just continue to patch those problems with sort of energy-intense solutions and expect to get any sort of mitigation effect.
Richard, in our final moments, give us a prediction, if you can. What do you think 2013 will have in store for us?
You know, it's always hard to predict the sort of weather climate collage that you see in any given year. You know, looking forward, you know, temperature-wise to a particular year, the things that meteorologists often look at is what's happening with El Nino and La Nina. And right now, it looks like that will be something of a neutral phase, which means that the variability, sort of the natural variability in the weather, is not suggesting any extreme. So with that, my sort of prediction for the next year is that it will continue to be a very warm year. We will see every month to continue to have above average temperatures in the continental United States and on the globe. And I fully expect that there will be a handful of extreme events, particularly precipitation events within, you know, the Midwest and Michigan. And right now it looks to me like we will have nationally tremendous challenges with continuing drought in large portions of the central part of the country.
Richard Root is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Michigan. He's a professor of atmospheric, oceanic, and space science, and also the climate change blogger at weatherunderground.com. Professor Root, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
So, yes, indeed, 2012 was warm. But right now in Michigan, it sure seems winter has truly arrived, not just on the calendar, but in the form of snow and ice. We can finally start to take advantage of a Michigan winter. Skiing, ice skating, ice fishing, those all come to mind. And then there's ice boating and ice racing. It's a winter pastime that's perfectly suited to Michigan. John Russell is one of those hardy, hard water sailors who cannot wait for the water to freeze over. He's the past president of the Grand Traverse Ice Yacht Club, and he joins us now. Happy New Year, John.
Thank you.
So describe for us, those of us who have never heard of it like me, what does an ice boat actually look like?
Well, there are a variety of them. The most common one is called a DN, which is named after the Detroit News, and I'll explain that in a minute. They're small sailboats, single hull, one person usually. They have a runner going perpendicular to the hull with steel blades on it. And when you get ice that's thick and safe without snow on it, you can sail on the lakes.
So in essence,
the boats have no brakes. You just you have a single sail. Most of them have single sails.
Okay.
And it's quite a thrill.
So in essence, it sounds like it's a little one-person sailboat on ice skates.
Yes.
And so when you're out there and you're on the lake and it's really ripping, how fast are you going?
Well, the speed records go up over 140 miles an hour for the really large boats. The typical small boat, like the DN, the 12-footers, can go up to 60 miles an hour.
So it strikes me that this is not a sport for the faint of heart.
It's not.
As you're out
there. We traditionally say you either love it or you don't.
Now, this is nothing new, right? How far back can you trace ice boating?
Well, this goes back to to Europe, actually, in the canal areas of Holland and the Scandinavian countries. They go back several hundred years to where they have evidence that that people would put ice skates on. They'd either hold a sail or they'd attach it to something with runners on it, maybe a sled or something, and sail the canals. It was a very effective way to move things, people and or freight. And then when the Dutch came to the New York area, they found the Hudson River frozen solid. They started building these huge ice boats up to 50 feet long. And traditionally, if they had to move them somewhere up or down river for where the good ice was, they'd put the boats, they were so big, they put them on railroad cars, travel up or down river until they found good ice. They'd use them to transport materials up and down the Hudson River to little villages.
So it actually started as something serious and part of commerce, but people being what they will, we have to turn things into sports, don't we?
They had to, yeah. They said, well, we had a lot of fun taking that case of beer up to Fishkill, New York. Let's go race.
We're talking with John Russell, who is the past president of the Grand Traverse Ice Yacht Club, talking about ice boating and ice racing. So, John, when did this come to Michigan, and how important has Michigan been in developing the sport of ice racing?
Well, Michigan, in the upper Midwest of Michigan in particular, has been very, very important to the sport of ice boating. Back in the mid-1930s, 1936, 37, the Detroit News, there were people that ice boated with little homemade devices on Lake St. Clair, on Anchor Bay, which is a shallow bay on Lake St. Clair, and usually has early ice and good ice.
Yeah.
And they go out and sail, and the Detroit News during the Depression said, let's have a workshop. They evidently had a big workshop area in their basement or somewhere. They said, we're going to develop an ice boat that can be built in your basement or in your garage by any home person and put it on the top of your car and go sailing. So the DN ice boat, named after the Detroit News, was developed. It's the largest single design ice, any sailboat in the world. There are over 8,000 DN ice boats running around the world.
And this is interesting. So what I think I'm hearing is that Michigan is the home of kind of incorporating and formalizing the racing action. And I think it's probably here in Michigan a sport that a lot of folks aren't familiar with.
Yeah, it's interesting because people come down and they'll watch the boats. And, of course, what gets you hooked, as it did with me 47 years ago, somebody there with an ice boat said, take my boat out. And they toss you a helmet. You get in the boat and you take off and you come back and you're either absolutely thrilled to death or you're scared to death. I was thrilled to death. I couldn't get enough of it.
Now, in your nearly 50 years, what can you tell us as far as the impact of what everybody feels is the fact that things are getting warmer? We're seeing less snow. Last winter, we virtually saw no snow. How has that impacted your sport?
It's made it very difficult to find sailable ice that's safe. Last year, there were two or three lakes in northern Michigan that we could sail, but it was only a week or two that they had the availability. I had my ice boat on my Jeep three different times. I never took it off because either it would snow Friday night or we'd get out there and find out the ice wasn't safe.
Mm.
They did do some sailing, but it was very minimal. It does have an impact on us. What's happened in the last few years, and I've seen a series of winters like this over the past four decades where you'll have 3 or 4 or 5 years, maybe even 7 years, where it's fairly warm. Then it turns around and gets cold again. We've been sailing as early as November, Thanksgiving weekend, and as late as Easter.
John, tell us, if you can, what does it feel like when you are out there, not even racing, but necessarily just on your own on the lake with your ice boat? What does it feel like?
Well, there's really nothing quite like it because you have very little sound. You have the runners, if you're on clear ice, you have the runners clanking and scraping a little bit. But you have a feeling of speed and exhilaration. I flew in a Blue Angel 10 years ago, and it reminded me of that. This instant acceleration. When you turn around an ice boat and there's no friction, like in a soft water boat, when you turn, the boat slows down and it gradually builds up speed. In an ice boat, if you turn real hard, you could pull 3 or 4 G's.
Wow.
And it's quite a thrill.
John Russell is the past president of the Grand Traverse Ice Yacht Club, and they're rolling out the welcome mat to anyone who'd like to come watch a race or perhaps even try helming an ice boat. You can get information at their website, gtyc.org. Now a quick note before we go to break. The Library of Michigan announced its 2013 Michigan Notable Books today, a list of 20 books that focus on Michigan history, places in the state, and its residents. Titles this year include The Boy Governor, a look at the life of Michigan Governor Stevens T. Mason. It's written by Don Faber. And Ink Trails by Jack Dempsey and Dave Dempsey. That one focuses on Michigan's famous and forgotten authors. Here at Stateside, we have actually spoken to some of the authors who made the Notable Books list. You can find our interview with soul singer Betty Levette on our website. We spoke with her about her autobiography, A Woman Like Me. And we talked with author Mark Benelli about his book, Detroit City is the Place to Be. You can find both of those interviews online at michiganradio.org. Still to come, it is January 2nd, and many of us have made resolutions for the new year, and likely many of us have probably already broken them. We'll talk to a researcher about why it is so hard to keep our promises to ourselves. That's coming up in 10 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's back to school day for students in Muskegon Heights. It's beginning the second half of what just about everyone agrees has been a pretty chaotic school year. Muskegon Heights has become Michigan's very first fully privatized school system. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith has been checking out the sometimes bumpy progress of this groundbreaking move, and she joins us now. So, Lindsay, spell out for us exactly what happened to Muskegon Heights schools last year and why.
So the school board voted in December of 2011, so about a year ago, to ask the state for an emergency manager. They've been losing students year over year. They've had rising costs, and they haven't been able to get it to balance for some time now. So the state appointed Don Weatherspoon as the emergency manager in April, and he realized pretty quickly that he didn't have enough money to reopen school in the fall. So kind of a big deal. So he decides to do something totally different. He creates a brand new school district, a legal entity by itself with zero debt. This new charter district hires Mosaic Education, this charter company, for 5 years. So that's really how they went through this whole process.
And what kind of track record does Mosaic Education have, especially in Michigan?
Well, Mosaic has been around since 1997. It's a private, for-profit charter company. It's based in New York, and it's a global company. They have about 90 schools in the U.S., the U.K., and India, and the Middle East. They have 6 schools in Michigan around Alpena and Metro Detroit and Flint and Pontiac. Now, all of those schools in Michigan have high rates of students that are in poverty. And about half of those 6 schools are meeting the federal No Child Left Behind standards, but half are not. The achievement rates at all of the Mosaic schools in Michigan are generally higher, though, than the averages in Muskegon Heights. Muskegon Heights has some of the lowest student achievement scores in Michigan. And Mosaica has had at least 3 other charter schools in Michigan at some time, but those charter school boards either closed or the boards decided to switch management companies for one reason or another.
Well, Lindsay, how did they fare in their first semester in Muskegon Heights? I believe you heard the word chaos quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the first semester was rough, but try setting up a brand new school district in less than 60 days. I mean, they knew it was going to be tough. I'm not sure if the chaos was more than what they expected or not. They had to get every student re-enrolled. They had to hire a full brand new staff. The high school principal quit the week before school started, so the superintendent had to fill in. And they had to do scheduling problems with the high school. They had no schedules, wrong schedules, duplicate classes. I heard some really crazy stories there. And then there was so much fighting at the high school at first that they ended up canceling homecoming dances. And then you've got these teachers that have quit. Then you've got to hire, train, get new ones to replace them. The company had to invest like $400,000 in building improvements just to get the state's like code inspector to approve them opening. So the buildings weren't really up to code before. And I mean, really, it comes down to a lot to do in a really, really short amount of time.
So launching into this second semester, maybe some of the dust has settled and proceeding ahead. Do you think there's a sense in the community and perhaps among students that this whole privatizing has been worth doing, or is it still too soon?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell. People are frustrated about specific things, I find, but they also realize that they don't know what could have been done instead. Like, they don't really have an alternative. And I think, honestly, I think that most people that I talk to are just really ready to get down to some kind of normal for a while and really do hope for the best.
Now, there are some critics of the way that Mosaic is getting paid. They're getting a flat fee, and you kind of wonder what's the incentive there to be efficient or to perform well.
Well, the incentive is really in attracting more students. They'll make at least $8.75 million over the five-year contract, but they have a potential to make up to $11 million if student enrollment, you know, surges, if they go way up. But there is also some language in the charter contract that would allow the new school board to get rid of Mosaica if the company is not meeting educational goals that the board and the Mosaica company have set. Now, they haven't gotten around to setting those goals yet, but they are likely to do so that later this month.
Are you hearing anything at all about this idea of total privatization? Is it being considered for other school districts in Michigan?
Highland Park did the same thing about a month after Muskegon Heights, and Don Weatherspoon is running that district now, too. There is this new emergency manager law that got signed last week, and it will once again allow emergency managers to break union contracts. So, I mean, conceivably, a manager appointed to a school district with financial problems could do the same thing. They could break the contracts. They could lay people off. They could hire a company to run things. So, you know, I think we'll see if it becomes a trend.
Lindsay Smith covers West Michigan for Michigan Radio, and you can find her reports on Muskegon schools online at michiganradio.org. Let's move now to New Year's resolutions. We may groan about them. We may proclaim we are above making them. But it somehow seems the new year does bring a longing for a fresh start, to make positive changes. Look no further than the crammed parking lots at gyms and fitness clubs in January, or the fresh burst of sign-ups at weight loss classes. So how do you keep that burst of good intentions you feel at the start of the new year and keep it going strong as the year goes on? Is it possible to turn a good intention into a lifelong good habit? University of Michigan psychologist Michelle Seeger joins us now in the studio. She's a motivation scientist, and she's the associate director of the university's Sport, Health, and Activity Research and Policy Center for Women and Girls. So, Michelle, it's not just me who has a really hard time sticking with those resolutions that we all make at the beginning of the year?
You know, most people you meet in the street will say the very same thing. How do you stick with New Year's resolutions? Everyone has great intentions. The problem is that we haven't been taught to convert our intentions into a sustainable behavior that we can stick with for the rest of our lives.
And that's the kind of work you're doing at the University of Michigan and the kind of research you're doing. So what are you finding? What is it that's not clicking that sounds so good in January and by June we're not at the health club?
So the problem is, if we start to exercise, for example, as a way to lose weight or benefit our health, we're not likely to stick with it. We haven't been taught to consider a behavior like exercise as a way to enhance our day immediately, now. And yet we know that physical activity, moving our bodies, does amazing things, like increases our energy and lifts our mood. We also know from research that immediate rewards, such as a lifted mood, for example, are more motivating than a reward we have to wait to achieve, like losing 50 pounds mm-hmm. or preventing cancer one day. When we do something like exercise for the immediate benefit to help us feel better now, we are so much more likely to stick with it. And that helps us lead happier and healthier lives.
If we start the year off and we start the workouts and we get on the treadmill or whatever it is we've determined we want to do, are we overlooking it?
That's exactly right. Oh. And that's a key point. Because we are so focused on achieving something specific, like potentially a change in blood pressure or changing those bad numbers on a scale, that is what our attention is focused on. Your question actually takes us to an interesting line of research that's not necessarily in the health field, but it's been consistent for 30 years. And that shows that when people set achievement goals, when they try to hit a target, if you will, instead of learn something, they are less successful. So when it comes to New Year's resolutions, what we want to do is we want to start thinking about how we can learn the behaviors, how to fit them into our lives instead of achieving a specific bullseye.
So instead of saying, I want to lose 50 pounds by my son's wedding in the fall, what should I be saying?
You should be saying, well, it's not that that's a bad goal
right.
to have, but if you want to sustain those 50 mm-hmm. pounds, then what you need to be saying is, I need to learn how to be successful for the rest of my life with the behaviors that are going to lead to those 50 pounds. I need to think about, how can I integrate physical activity into my life in a way that I can sustain? How can I change my dietary habits in ways that it's not going to be hit or miss, but that I'm going to feel motivated to stick with? We need to shift our framework for thinking about the goal to thinking about the acts.
The how?
The how, yes, the how.
Mm. When you're saying we need to learn these things, how? In what way?
Well, there are a few key things that people can learn that can change their likelihood of being successful. And one thing that we're learning with newer science relates to motivation and emotion and affect, and that is that how we feel about a behavior, for example, determines the quality of motivation we have. So if we're exercising to lose weight and we're going to the gym and we're getting on the Stairmaster and we're thinking, I've got to burn those calories, that's likely to create a negative feeling toward mm-hmm. exercising. And guess what? Who's got time to fit in something that they're actually going to feel bad about? So one of the reframes and the new things we have to learn is that how we feel about the behavior influences us unconsciously. So what we want to do is we want to pick behaviors, if we're talking about exercise, pick physical activities that feel good to do. We've got to throw out the one-size-fits-all prescriptions, believe it or not. Those don't help people stick with it. And what we need to be focused on is, again, it's not about doing something. It's about sticking with it long term.
So it sounds like the health and the diet and fitness industry aren't marketing this to us the right way.
That, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly right.
What messages are there? Are the ones that we need to maybe tune out?
Well, we've basically been taught to think about these behaviors, healthy eating, sleep, stress reduction, exercise, in very medicalized way. We are prescribed these things as medication, a bitter pill to take. Again, we're too busy. Our lives are too hectic to do things that make us feel bad and that don't enhance our lives. The irony is that all of the behaviors that lead us to be healthy also help us feel happier and be more energized and really realize our full potential. So the shift in marketing that needs to happen is we have to go from a medicalized approach, the bitter pill approach for behavior, and talk about how it can help us thrive in our daily lives.
You hear research that says, handed down from somewhere on high,
yes,
an hour a day of exercise is what a woman needs to be able to not even lose weight, but to keep from gaining more. And you think, where in the world am I going to find that?
It's a problem. And we need to understand how to help people integrate small pieces in ways that they can, A, feel good from, and B, learn to sustain.
We're talking with University of Michigan psychologist Michelle Seeger. She is a motivation scientist. So we are exploring ways to take what many of us call those New Year's resolutions, if that's the label you put on them, but to take these good impulses and turn them into sustainable habits. Let's talk a little about other bad habits. Let's say smoking. What does it take to successfully quit and make that a lifelong habit?
Well, you know, what it takes for one person to quit is going to be different than another. There's with smoking, there's an addictive component. Some people find that using patches that help them wean themselves, they'll be more likely to be successful. A strategy that can be used in smoking cessation, as well as really any behavior, mm-hmm. Is called if-then planning. Another term is implementation intentions. And this is a key to being successful, and we haven't been taught to do this.
So what would that mean?
It means that you strategize about your life. If something's important to you, like stopping to smoke or exercising more, the trick is you have to do that in your daily life. So you need to strategize, well, how am I going to be successful in my daily life? Well, what's likely to get in my way? This is where the bridge comes. You predetermine and you learn from experience what's going to get in my way, and then you pre-plan, well, if this happens or when this happens, then I'm going to do this. So you basically create a toolkit so it's already in your mind. And research shows that what that does is it doesn't just help us be strategic. It actually automates the behavior so that we have to use less of our mindful, effortful cognitive processes, which wear out during the day. And when we automate it, it makes it much more likely to happen because it goes into our unconscious.
So I'm going to give you a scenario and tell me how this would apply. I know I need to work out. When am I going to find the time? I have a 100-mile a day commute. So by the time I get home, we do dinner. I have homework for the next day. I'm tired. What do I do?
That's a great question. I would say to you that that's probably a question 95% of mm-hmm. individuals might have. The first part of the solution is you have to have a why, a reason for trying to be more physically active that is truly compelling to you. We have got to get away from the abstract and often self-rejecting reasons such as I have to lose those 50 pounds, mm-hmm. I have to fit into those jeans, I want to be a healthier person. We have to move away from those reasons and turn to specific purposes for behavior that makes it truly compelling to fit in. So I would say to that person, mm-hmm. well, why do you want to be more physically active? What is it that you are trying to get out of fitting that into your day? The second part is finding physical activities that, if at the very least, are tolerable, if right. not, feel good. And most people I found, and this has been amazing to me over the years, that most people don't really understand that walking, and it doesn't even have to be at a fast pace, that walking really is valid physical movement. So I would tell that person who has this really long commute, uh-huh. where are the opportunities in your daily life, and I call these opportunities to move, where are the opportunities that you could claim and plan and strategize and make into social experiences? 5, 2 minutes, 15 minutes, build them in. And again, if we're taking a lifelong view of behavior, give yourself 3 to 12 months to learn how to fit this into your life in ways that you can sustain. And I would say, and this is another really important point, and don't try to change anything else at the same time. We've been taught to make multiple changes at the same time.
Yes.
So if you're trying to both, for example, exercise more and change your diet.
And maybe quit smoking.
And maybe quit smoking, you know, and be a more patient parent mm-hmm. and everything else. There simply isn't the energy in our minds to successfully do those. So pick the thing that is most compelling to you, that's mm-hmm. most going to impact your daily life, and give yourself 9 months to learn how to do it. Mm. It's you have to tailor this to who you are and what you want your daily life to be like. And then you have to be very strategic and say, if this is an important goal for me, then I'm going to care about protecting it and pre-planning and previewing and being strategic and getting support from people who I know can help me be successful.
And the payoff?
The payoff is that you're much more likely to A, stay motivated to do it, and B, to make it a priority in your daily life.
Thoughts for starting out the new year. University of Michigan psychologist Michelle Seeger, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us, Michelle.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.